Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr.
And I'm Mel Valentin, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies.
Yay, Mel is back. You were originally going to be back, about a month ago? And then
yes.
You got super Ebola or something
like that? Yeah. Pneumonia, bronchitis, head cold, chest cold, everything all at once.
A capuchin monkey had eaten your lunch or something like that, and you got his saliva.
No, I ate his lunch. So.
You ate his lunch?
Yeah, I was hungry. Sorry.
You didn't have sex with Gwyneth Paltrow or something like that, and then spread super flu to everybody.
Not that I recall, but I have some black spots in my memory there, so anything is possible.
And you would want to black out, Gwyneth Paltrow.
Actually, yes, I would.
It's Gwyneth Paltrow. There's needs no more explanation. You know what is funny? It's the Brad Pitt effect. I'm actually coining it. If it's a celebrity woman who's dated or had a long-standing relationship or married Brad Pitt, they are just, I don't give a rat's patootie about them. I mean, you got Gwyneth Paltrow. I don't care about her. Jennifer Aniston, really don't care about her. Angelina Jolie. Why is she making movies in Cambodia with a $1,500 purse in tow? God knows why. So
I thought it was.
I don't know. Did I step
Bosnia
on your toes?
Or wasn't it Eastern Europe? But.
Well, it was like her movie Land of Blood and Honey. That's
yes.
that's Bosnia or Croatia. Or
yes,
something
it is.
Like that.
Yes, which I haven't seen yet. Unfortunately, they tried to cram in that screening very late in the game, and it just.
They're
doable.
Just not screening it for us, so oh well. She did this. She did this Louis Vuitton ad, like a big advertisement. It was the back of a magazine, and she's in a swamp, and it's something about her. It's Angelina Jolie's stories, and it's sponsored by Louis Vuitton, and she's in this swamp on this rickety old boat in like what looks like just sort of like what you'd wear in Cambodia, just this. Very common or thing. And she's got this Louis Vuitton bag, which I looked up and it's like $1,500.
Interesting. Okay.
It makes no sense. It's just like, it breaks your brain to watch this thing. Cause you're just like, huh?
Well, I mean, she wants to have it both ways. I guess George Clooney's is the same way, use the millions to live a very lavish lifestyle and go around being a humanitarian ambassador as well. And it, I guess in her case, right, she's put up some of her own money for the movie.
Who cares?
Okay. Well, I think if you believe in a cause and you make a film, regardless of the quality, there's something I find admirable in that.
Okay.
Enjoying her millions and spending it for some good cause.
That's wonderful. I'm more in line with what Bruno says, where he says, whatever's Dar 4, I'm looking for what Dar 5 is.
I don't remember that line from.
Yeah, it was when he had the image consultants.
Okay. Right.
Anyways, before we talk a little bit more to Mel here, let's get through some paperwork. You can go to fatguysatthemovies.com, check us out. You can go to iTunes and search Fat Guys at the Movies or Fat Guys Network, and we'll pop right up, write us a review. Tell us how awesome we are, please, because that's something we need just to make ourselves stronger and fight Freddy Krueger in our dreams. You can go to facebook.com/FGATM and like our page, which will be great. You can go to you can email us, fatguys@filmschoolrejects.com. We got something from email and something from the Facebook page. So we'll answer those wonderful questions from our listenership in a later segment. You can leave us a voicemail at 740-205-6456. No creditors, please. I do not respond to those, no matter how much money I owe you. Student loans are there forever. Thank you very much.
Oh, I know those very well. Thank you.
So say hi to the audience, Mel. You haven't been on. It's been about 6 months or 5 months at
least.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, I was hoping to be on before Thanksgiving, and that didn't work out. But yeah, it's been a while. And I'm happy to be back.
The bat swine flu from Contagion took you over.
And part of that is set in San Francisco, where I'm living, living. Yeah. So
where there are monkeys
sites.
Swinging from the trees, biting people and giving people...
Oh, right. Well, you can mix both movies up, Contagion and Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Just everything.
Although, of course, Rise of the Planet of the Apes is mostly filmed in Vancouver and it shows.
Well, hey. Nobody outside of San Francisco cares.
Right. I just love it when they go through neighborhoods like, that looks like nothing. Those trees. Yeah, I don't think we have those type of trees in San Francisco, but you're right.
Oh, well. It's still a great movie. Tell us where you're from and what you do and all that good stuff before we move on to some reviews here.
Movie sites, you mean? I currently write for...
How people can get a hold of you and read your awesomeness.
Oh, okay. Well, great. E-Film Critic is one of my sites. I've been writing for them for 6 years. SF Station is another site. I've been writing for them for 6 years as well. And that's a local site, sfstation.com. And since this past summer, I've been writing for veryaware.com. And I've also written for a bunch of other sites, Cinematical and Movie Vault. I think that's it for now.
Isn't FS Station also known as VBC Station for Vancouver, British Columbia?
It probably should
be. In movie terms. Well, good to have you back on. We always do the live tweets and that sort of thing on Saturday night. But we're taking a break because Saturday night is
Christmas Eve
and then New Year's Eve. And I'm not live tweeting with you guys. I'm going to actually try and do something fun.
Always fun. We just did Lethal Weapon. That was a
Lethal Weapon was such an epic tweet. That was awesome.
That was one of my favorites, I have to say.
And we did Santa Claus the movie, which was just crazy. And
also
then
another favorite.
Games. Reindeer Games was so bad. So,
which sadly I missed.
Yeah. Well, you didn't miss much. let's move on to the reviews really quickly.
Yes.
We may spill over into the next segment when we talk about this. But this movie is The Adventures of Tintin. Steven Spielberg directs the motion capture adaptation of the classic Belgian story of a young reporter trying to find a treasure.
Look at this. It was long claimed the ship was carrying a secret cargo.
The model ship conceals a clue
to one of the greatest secrets in all history.
I'm warning you. Get out where you still can. These people do not play nice.
I will find that ship, with or without your help.
Thanks. I'm Tintin, by the way.
You got to see this, didn't you?
I did, indeed. I saw it
a few weeks ago.
I think we talked about this earlier about Warhorse versus Tintin. I hated Warhorse, and relatively speaking, I loved Tintin. I had some issues with it. Still not a fan of motion capture. I think they probably should have gone a little bit more toward the caricature part and not toward making the lead character and some of the other characters look too human. You still have the Uncanny Valley issue that just... It's too distracting. Still takes me out of the film.
And I didn't think the Uncanny Valley was near. I thought he did much better with the Uncanny Valley than like Robert Zemeckis.
Absolutely, yeah. No, it has improved over almost a decade since Polar Express came out, but there's still just some element about that.
Polar Express. What about Mars Needs Moms? That was earlier this year, and that looked hideous.
It was horrible, and it bombed badly. So I think
because it was a terrible movie.
Yes, apart from the motion capture. So. Yeah. But what I loved about Tintin is that he just sort of Stephen Moffat, Doctor Who, and Sherlock, mm-hmm. and Edgar Wright, Shaun of the Dead, and Hot Fuzz, and Scott Pilgrim.
Joe Cornish, I think, was involved in it, too.
Yeah, Attack the Block. So they had three great writers to adapt the Tintin stories. I think it was actually two or three of the Tintin stories written in the 40s that were adapted for the film. And I thought it was fantastically done, very much in sort of the Indiana Jones Jr., way of doing things. Very little character development, just push into the story right away, reveal a little bit of character. One of the funny things is that he's a reporter, but you actually never see him taking down any notes or writing anything down or sending in a story, because he's just an adventure seeker, and he's always on the go. So and I thought the action sequences were among the best that Spielberg has done. I think obviously the CG environments allowed him, and animation allowed him to explore things as far as possible, as far as his imagination could go.
Yeah, definitely. We actually are almost out of time, so I think when we come back, I'll dive in and talk a little bit about my Tintin. So really, real quick, rocks or sucks? What do you think?
Oh, rocks.
Okay, yes. Cool. Well, with that, we're going to go to a break. And welcome back to Fat Guys in the Movies. I'm just going to leap right in here and get my review of Tintin out of the way, since we kind of jumped out of the last segment with that. I grew up in the 80s and the 70s. I was born in 1971. So as much as I identify myself as a Star Wars baby, and I love Star Wars, even the prequels, so to you. not to you personally, but to everybody out there who's going to be like, the idea of like George Lucas, shut up. Just deal with it.
I absolutely abhor the prequels, but that's okay.
That's fine.
I still love the original trilogy, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah, but I also, as much as George Lucas affected my childhood, Steven Spielberg did, because I was 9 when Raiders of the Lost Ark came out. And when I bought a VCR for the very first time, first movie I bought on VHS back in the 80s was Raiders of the Lost Ark. I loved it. I loved all the Indiana Jones movies. I even enjoyed this last one. So I love that sort of that sense of adventure going back to the serialized feel of these movies where you have this sort of improbable character defending himself and people firing real guns at him. It went back to Tintin, totally goes back to that sense of adventure from the Indiana Jones movies. You know, it's that sweeping treasure hunt over oceans and deserts, and it's just multiple locations.
Absolutely,
and
yes.
Flying planes and on battleships and that sort of thing. It does get a little, I'm going to warn, it gets a little anticlimactic at the end because the big climactic chase scene is not the last one. The big climactic action scene is not the last one. But all is forgiven for me. I had such fun watching this movie. And while I don't think this 3D is necessary, and I'm a big proponent of 3D, I will defend 3D, I appreciate the fact that we have master directors like Spielberg and Scorsese who are dipping their toe in that water and kind of showing these young pups saying, we're actually going to do something with this,
right,
as opposed to just slap it on. So yeah, I think Tintin rocks. It was a great movie, and I'd love to see more, which there will be because it's already made like $300 million overseas.
Elsewhere. Yeah, it's a big question mark how we'll do here. Because he's not quite as popular. I mean, he's sort of a fringe comic book artist. Jackson and Spielberg obviously loved him and wanted to adapt his works, and hopefully, sure. I'd like to see more too. I had some minor quibbles, and one of them was the treasure is actually a treasure. The gold, the object of desire that they're looking for, seemed just a bit too mundane. You know, especially after the Indiana Jones movies, where there's always something really big and it didn't have to be supernatural. It just had to be something that actually wasn't a treasure, but that's
the original story.
Yes.
I actually Shout Factory released the old adaptations cartoons from the 90s recently, and they've got the story in there. It's like a 3-part cartoon, you know, so it's like 100 minutes or something like that. So, anyways, it rocks. Let's move on to the next one because we've got a lot of movies to talk about because they're releasing 586 this week. The next one up is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. David Fincher directs this remake of the Swedish film about an investigator trying to solve a 50-year-old murder.
I need your help. You come stay on the island. A way of avoiding all those people you might want to avoid right now. You will be investigating thieves, misers, bullies, the most detestable collection of people that you will ever meet. My family. This is Harriet. Someone in the family murdered Harriet. And for the past 40 years, has been trying to drive me insane.
All right, you go first. You saw this. What do you think?
Well, I guess, have a first question whether you should call it a remake or a new adaptation. I think Fincher would probably say it's a new adaptation of the same source material.
It's a remake.
Obviously, there are a lot of elements, and even some of the shots are very similar. But I think Fincher's interpretation of the material, his visuals, he's a magnificent visual storyteller. If I had to watch them both again, I think there's no comparison. And if you look at the two directors side by side, you look at the direction, you can just basically see a journeyman, craftsman, who's technically competent versus someone who is basically at the top of his craft, who I think is, he's an A-list director based on the budgets he works with and the material, but just the level of skill that he brings to directing on a visual basis and performances too. I think he gets his direction of actors is probably not considered among his best attributes or talents. But I think after you see Dragon Tattoo with Daniel Craig, it's a great cast, obviously, so that's half the battle. But Rooney Mara was just an absolute revelation.
She was fantastic. I thought she did. Everyone was all nervous with her.
I was too. You
know. Noomi Rapace was. Is that how you say her name? I think she did a great job. And there are people who'd be like, why didn't she reprise her role? She probably didn't want to. Why would she want to play the exact same role in the exact same movie by another director and butt heads with him?
And she did all three films. And at this point, she's 31. So I think, she's moved on. She wants to do other roles. And, she landed a supporting role in Sherlock Holmes, too, which wasn't a major role and I think actually contributed a little. But Ridley Scott saw something in her, too, since she's got the lead in Prometheus coming out next year, the alien prequel that's not really a prequel. So, she's doing, I think, quite well for herself. I love that they both brought different qualities to the performances. Mm. Rapace was much quieter, still intense, but I think there was a stillness about her where she was more observant and ready to react, whereas Rooney was just incredibly intense and intense throughout in her performance. And I loved her use of body language. It didn't feel fake or forced or contrived. Yeah. It felt like it was really natural to the character and her troubled, traumatized past. Again, you know, she was fantastic in Social Network, but that was one or two scenes that she was in.
She sucked in Social Network was a crappy movie anyways.
Okay, I didn't love it, but liked it.
This is the thing. I'm not like this Fincher can do no wrong kind of guy, because I think some of his movies are absolute garbage. I think Social Network was lame. I thought the Benjamin Button was a bore. You know, you got Alien 3, which everyone's like, oh, that's 20th Century Fox. I mean, no, it's the guy who directed the damn movie's fault for not playing the game. You don't sit there and get your first franchise out of music videos and then not play the game. What are you, an idiot? Now he can take take that stance and say, I'm not going to, you know, play the game. But so, I mean, but I do like some of his. I thought Seven was great. I thought Fight Club was pretty good. I thought Zodiac was great. I think this one's a great movie. So for somebody like me, who's not just automatically going to say Fincher's a genius, I really did enjoy it. So I think it was a great movie, and I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was weird because there's this like little bit of a nuance to the character. She's always eating Happy Meals because she eats small bits. She's, you know, every now, so she's constantly eating a Happy Meal. I'm like, that's gonna be the most awkward toy tie-in that you'll ever see, because it's Alvin and the Chipmunks now, but I think, are they gonna do like dragon tattoos? Like, hey, can I get the sexual assault toy instead of the tattoo toy?
Well, there's a clothing line that's being put out.
Of course there is.
You know, I mean, so there you
have the 12-year-old girls.
You can dress just like Lisbeth Salander from the dragon tattoo movies. But.
You know what I think would have been better, though, with this movie? I mean, as great as the acting was, I wish, and it was my kids who gave me this idea, if they had, since it's a remake of the Swedish movie and it takes place in Sweden, it doesn't like take place in Long Island or something like that.
Right.
They didn't move it to America. And so that a lot of people are speaking in Swedish accents, and they have...
Outside of Daniel Craig, who's like, screw it, I'm not doing one. I can't do one, so I'm not going to even try it.
I give him credit. At least he didn't do like some sort of Kevin Costner.
I honestly appreciate it. If you can't do it, don't do it. Don't give it a
wish,
shot, you know?
I wish they had everyone had spoken like the Swedish chef through the entire movie and just had him go...
So completely incomprehensible.
And then have subtitles underneath it.
Yes.
That would have been so awesome. I'm waiting for that fan edit of that to be... a chicken boy. You know, or something like that. Anyways, we got to move on to the next movie. So rate it real quick. Sucks, rocks, kind of sucks.
It rocks for the first 2 hours and sucks for the last 40 minutes. But we talked about that offline a little bit, that... I just felt it dragged
don't
a little
talk,
bit too much.
Yeah, we don't want to talk too much about what happens at the end because, you know, no spoilers or anything. I was okay with it, actually, which is odd because, like I said, I usually find, especially recent works by David Fincher somewhat tedious. But I kind of liked what they did. I understood what he was going for, so it didn't bother me.
And overindulgence, I think, has become an element of his directing style in the last few films. They've gotten increasingly longer once he's obtained a freedom to basically do whatever he wants. And I think that can often be a negative for directors who aren't under the control of, you know, a studio that's saying, dude, you have to release a 2-hour, 20-minute movie, 2.5 hours. That's your upper limit. You know, 2 hours should be optimal.
We got to go to the next movie because we're running out of time here. But this next one, another Spielberg movie, because it makes no sense to at all not release the director's two big movies of the year.
Within 5 days.
4 days from each other.
Yeah.
And this is War Horse. It's another Spielberg film about a horse and his boy against the backdrop of World War I.
What is it?
It's a horse they find wandering about in no man's land.
What kind of an horse?
A miraculous kind of an horse, be my guess.
England is at war! We are at war!
I promise you that I'll look after him. If I can, I'll return him to your care.
Thank you. 22 miles of hard road, 33 years of tough luck, 44 skulls buried in the ground, crawling down through the muck. Oh yeah.
And welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies. We just went out on the War Horse trailer, which is, it's a terrible trailer. And I just want to make that point because, although I do have a sense that we're going to disagree on this one because you kind of already played your hand on that earlier. But this is a very hard movie to make a trailer of because I thought the trailer was just absolutely atrocious. Didn't give a sense of the movie at all. Then I saw the movie and I was like, oh, okay. But it's an accurate trailer. It's just really hard. It's sort of like it's like a novel that's really hard to blurb on the back, or a movie that's hard to, like, you remember The Golden Compass? That movie was impossible to like summarize in like a sentence. I mean, you're like, well, it's this thing, and then this guy is traveling and this flying, and then, you know,
it's
no
alternate
God,
dimension, ultimate universe.
There's this wicked cool polar bear fight.
right, yeah. You
know? So, I'll give you first crack at War Horse.
Okay, whoever called it Boar Horse was probably right, or saving Mr. Ed, saving Private Ed. War Horse is probably one of the, it's going to go down as probably the most disappointing film of the year for me. And
really?
Yes. I ended up hating it with actually quite a passion. Wow. It was just so overwrought. I mean, it was Spielberg at his absolute excessive worst. From the beginning to the end, John Williams. I love so many films of Spielberg's. I
love you throw their John Williams. Bad John Williams.
And John Williams could be a fantastic composer and has been, but I thought this was one of his less original scores, and he just pushed it very far. And
well,
of course,
you do know that most people would tell you that a real composer would tell you that the Star Wars theme is just the score from Star Wars is right out of the planets. I think is what.
Oh, horse. The planets. The inspiration. You mean?
Yeah,
but he's done so many, I think, great scores in and around that, and you know, Indiana Jones. They've worked together their entire careers, and that's really remarkable. And I think Spielberg has gotten his absolute best work. I don't know if you've heard any of Williams' scores before he started working with Spielberg, and they were fairly generic. So something about their collaboration really forced or compelled Williams to bring his A game to it. But anyway, back to it. You've heard the phrase, and I couldn't help but think of it so many times, especially in the first 20 minutes, when it's basically just a love story between a boy and his horse named Joey. The Spielberg face, you know, the look of awe and wonderment that Spielberg just loves to throw in his films. Usually, they're fine, but he includes one almost every other minute, if not more often. And it's just pushing the camera in where, you know, you have the beatific face of the young actor, Jeremy Irvine, I believe his name is, looking up in awe with his mouth half open. And he just kept repeating that shot. And then Williams' score just building to a crescendo. And then the reverse shot, there's the horse. Isn't it a beautiful horse? I mean, I honestly expect him to jump over the fence and just start caressing the horse, and then they would just go off into something horribly pornographic that we never want to
suddenly
think
it turns
about.
Into a donkey show.
Yeah, it's nothing we ever want to really imagine or think about, but thought it anyway. So, and I thought there were individual vignettes.
You really are bringing the hate on this. You're not. I mean, it's not just like I didn't like it. It's like he almost raped a horse in this movie, and I hated that. John Williams, bastard.
There were individual vignettes that were fantastic. The story with
just the name John Williams just becomes an argument. John Williams.
No. But when he leaves his company, when Joey leaves the young characters, Albert's company. That first segment with the cavalry, fantastic. And the set pieces, fantastic. I love the story of the two German brothers, how that was played out. Anything other than that. And then, of course, you have the end scene in No Man's Land. Don't want to give too much away about what happens there.
Careful of spoilers. This movie hasn't even come out.
Right. But we're talking about individual set pieces that Spielberg is a master at. You know, action choreography. And I love the fact that, you know, he's still, given where he started in his career, where he's moved to, he's never lost the fact that the audience should be able to appreciate what and where every character and every object is from shot to shot. Yeah. And I appreciate that highly. I just felt as a film, it failed. Individually, segments were very strong, but ultimately I couldn't recommend it.
So it's a full on suck for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
See, now here's the thing. I don't disagree that it's a real button pusher, and he throws all his standard tricks in the book, but he does them well, I think. And I think it's a testament to the fact that I was dreading watching this movie. And I put the movie in because I actually got a screener. I was lucky enough to get an award screener for this, even though I was later told by my DreamWorks rep that they're like, they weren't supposed to send those out yet. You're supposed to see it in the theater. I'm like, I'll try and make that screening. I still watched it.
Yeah, I still had a screen. And yeah. I noticed there was a slip of the tongue there when you called. You said Disney.
Well, it's Disney because Disney is partnered with DreamWorks.
Right. But don't you think that War Horse is pretty much a war film as told through the Disney prism?
Well, but that's what it's based on, a book. It's based on a kid's book. So,
right, it's based on a kid's book, and there was a Tony-winning play, all of that, yeah.
And that's why I was so forgiving. But I also, I liked the fact that it was a sweeping, beautiful movie, and I thought it was epic, and I enjoyed what he did with it. I totally, it's one of those things, I guess you have to sit there and say, okay, this is what the movie's going to be. And within the first half hour, you know what it's going to be for the next two. And
it's 2.5 hours, isn't it? Right. Yes.
Yeah. And I think it worked. I was completely taken in by it. I thought it was beautifully shot. It was a real button pusher. Sure. You know what it's like? It's like another DreamWorks movie, The Help, which I thought was an absolute utter button pusher. But it was done very well. It achieved what it was supposed to achieve. And I'm actually going on record and said this. I've said this several places. I think War Horse, even though I don't think it's the best, I don't personally think it's the best of the year. It might make my top 10 list. I don't think it's necessarily the best movie of the year, but I do think it's going to win the Oscar for Best Picture because it's exactly what the Academy wants. I think it's the Dances with Wolves of 2011.
And I sincerely hope you're 100% wrong. it came up in our critics discussion, our critic circle discussion before we voted, and I was among those who were really vocal about War Horse, and I think that helped to knock it out from consideration. And I was incredibly happy about that, I have to say.
I don't know. I also found it amazing that it's it was very uplifting, even for a war film, which I thought was a challenge.
I expected as much, I guess. And I went in actually hoping for the best and received the worst from Spielberg. And I can't recommend it to anyone, absolutely. Even family, you know, the family orientation aspect, no.
I do recommend it. I say it rocks. So let's go to the next one, which is actually opened last week. And we talked a little bit about it last week with Gray Drake from the Popcorn Mafia and CNN and Movies.com, and she assured me that this movie was, quote, so dope. And I have to say, we'll hear what I have to say here in a second. It's Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. The wide release of the latest Mission Impossible film sees Ethan Hunt and his team trying to avert a nuclear threat.
Ethan, what happened in the Kremlin?
It was a setup.
The Russians are classifying this as an undeclared act of war. The blame points to you and your team. The president has initiated Ghost Protocol. The entire IMF has been disavowed.
So what happens now? The four of us are all that remains of the IMF. We come back with our target, or we don't come back.
Mel, what did you think of this movie? Did you see it?
I think you'd have to be a dope to call it dope, but okay. Or be on dope to call it dope. Mission Impossible 4, Ghost Protocol, fantastic action sequences. I love what Brad Bird did with the film visually. Again, the action choreography was among the best I've seen in a very long time, and I wish other directors in Hollywood would sort of take Mission Impossible 4 as a template for what they should do and what they should present to audiences.
I hear a big butt coming up. I hear a Rosie O'Donnell sized big butt coming up.
Rosie O'Donnell, thank you for that image, which I will not be able to erase from my mind.
You're going
to
be thinking
I'm going
to
dream about it, and I'm
going to
blame you for
it.
I'm going to be cursing you. Why couldn't they have spent a little bit more time on the script, maybe, and a better villain? I mean, if the rule, the argument that an action film is only as good as its villain, then Mission Impossible 4 isn't very good because the villain is just so
underrated. Well, I think there's an exception to that.
He's sort of a sub Bond villain. I mean, his motivations make absolutely no sense. He's a Swedish-born Russian nuclear strategist who thinks that he should end the world and start anew. I'm like, what? Really? Come on.
That rule only works if the movie's not so dope.
if it was not so dope. And it's not that I don't and won't recommend it. I have, but there's, I think, a major qualification there. And I'm not anti-Tom Cruise, regardless of all his other nonsense outside of his film work. I like to always try to separate what a actor does mm-hmm. in and out of film, regardless of what their politics are or their yeah. thoughts on psychotherapy may be, and his are probably or are incredibly wrong. But, okay. you know, if you can see it in IMAX, see it in IMAX, because it's, you know, that's what Brad Bird did. There are multiple action sequences filmed in that, and they're really stupendous. Yeah. Impressive.
See, I'm totally in the so dope camp, and you're right, because it's not a fantastic story. It's a total 80s throwback story. I mean, it's literally what they make fun of in the Austin Powers movie. I'm gonna steal a nuclear weapon right. and threaten to blow something up. That's literally what goes on in this
film.
And
start World War III for no yeah. real reason. But
okay. And I also think it's funny that the guy who played the original Mikael Bloomquist is the bad guy in this, and you had the original Lisbeth Salander in Sherlock Holmes last week too. So they're obviously getting work elsewhere. But this movie, it was one of those movies I think transcended that rule, transcended the whole, you need to have that great villain. I was okay with sort of the Bond-esque, you know, sort of low-rent Bond-esque, because it's not about the villain. It's about the threat and then about them. And the ancillary villains, like the ridiculously attractive 15-year-old prostitute assassin.
She was in Midnight in Paris, by the way.
Was she? Was she the one in the...
She was essentially, the bookseller.
The one who was way too fucking young for Owen Wilson.
Yes, but I don't think he minded in that, but...
I don't think so. But, so, I mean, there's a lot of ridiculous to it. I mean, it's a ridiculous movie, but it's so fun. And what I loved about it is nonstop action. And I was very skeptical going in, because I'm skeptical of every movie that Brad Bird has ever done, because I don't think it's going to be as good as it is. And then I see it, and I'm like, this is a great freaking movie. I did that with The Iron Giant. I did that with The Incredibles. I did it with Ratatouille, although I wasn't a huge fan of Ratatouille. It's still a great movie.
Yes.
But this one, it was just... It was such fun. I have not had this much fun in a movie theater without something else happening in the movie theater. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. Details or?
No, I have not had this much fun in a movie in so long, and the action is just so fun, so ridiculous, and so cool to see. It's a benefit to it that it really never slows down. I mean, and somebody said to me once that we're talking about it, and they said, "Oh well, you know, it's I didn't think the acting was that bad." I go, "There's no acting in it. It's just it's like there's literally two scenes of dialogue, and then the third one at the very very end. There's really only two scenes that have any sort of necessary dialogue in it. Everything else is just about the action, about the mission." And that's what makes it so fun. Yeah, so, I mean, it's the best action movie of 2011 by a mile. You know, forget Transformers 3, forget Fast 5. This is the best action movie. And it's going to make my top 10 list, actually.
Wow.
Totally rocks.
Wow. Well, I'll agree with you, considering that those two other films aren't particularly high-end. And I would never put Transformers 3 on anything except the worst list, worst of the year list. And Fast, well... What about Drive? Drive has some action. No,
Drive's not an action movie. It's nominated. I'm in the BFC. It's nominated for Critics' Choice as an action movie, and that's bullshit because it's not an action movie. It's a drama. It's a crime drama.
It's a neo-noir crime drama.
Calling Drive. I mean, it's not like you say action movie and somebody be like, "What action? Whoa, that's not an action movie." It's not like saying The Help is an action movie.
Yes. Well, it has several action scenes, and I think they're incredibly well directed and choreographed.
But it's not an action movie.
No.
Yeah. It'd be like calling The Terminator a romance. Well, I mean, it's in there.
Yeah, it's secondary. It's secondary, absolutely. Yeah. And secondary is probably a stretch.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's critical to the story, but it's still, Terminator's not a romance. So anyways, yeah, we'll disagree a little bit. Maybe not as much as we disagreed on War Horse.
Which I hated. Which I hated. In case that wasn't clear, I hate it.
I heard that one.
Four horse.
Do you want to quickly just rattle through a couple? We got a couple limited releases that are out and expanding this week. We're not going to spend too much time on them. I haven't actually seen this first one, and that's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Just give me the real quick rundown what you thought of this film.
The quick rundown was that it's an adaptation that shouldn't have been adapted, a book that shouldn't have been adapted, at least not the way it was done. It was.
Is it as bad? Is it like as convoluted as Tristram Shandy? a cock and bull story?
Which I loved. Well, no, in this case, it's a first-person narrative that just cannot be translated because that's the selling point of the novel. You know, this preteen genius with who may or may not have Asperger's, and trying to import that into a film where the actor, Thomas Horn, I feel deeply sorry for him because either he was miscast or misdirected, but he was a failure in so many different scenes. He worked in a couple, and it does sort of play the Spielberg game of being over-manipulative with you know, music cues and camera angles and camera movements and lots of spinning camera. And,
are you going to throw John Williams in there just to drive
it home? No, the French composer Alexander Desplat did the score and did it in a very brief time, 3 weeks. And it shows because it's not one of his better scores, and I think he's one of the better composers working today. And if you haven't heard of him, look him up, and you'll see he's actually done some incredible scores, including the last couple Harry Potter films.
Oh, okay.
So he's up there, not in John Williams' territory as far as, no, a consistent body of work. But I think give him another 5-10 years, and he'll probably be the premier composer of his generation.
Okay. He'll be the next Howard Shore, yeah. Kind of what you're saying.
Yes. Howard Shore?
All right,
okay.
I was thinking more of Hans Zimmer.
But.
Okay, real quick, the artist. What do you think of the artist? Do you think it's worth the accolades it's getting?
Not all of them. It's worth some of the accolades. Mm-hmm. But best film, I think that's a stretch. Top 10 material, top 20, possibly top 20, top 10 maybe not. I think it's effortlessly
entertaining. What about top 18?
Okay, 18 maybe. It's effortlessly entertaining. It's pastiche. It's homage to a silent film about the silent film era. It has so many great moments. You know, it's sort of light farce, romance, melodrama. I love how they segue from one genre to another. Mm-hmm. And it really sort of keeps the film light, even when it goes into really sort of heavier territory. The performances are fantastic. The camera work is, you know, very imitative of the time. So I think it's very much a sort of loving homage to the period. But there's no depth. There, you know, you don't look at the film and think that there's anything profound about it and the themes.
It's a total light, fluffy, airy movie.
Yes.
I thought it was really well done. I mean, it was neat to see. Runs a little long because actually, if you go movies from that era, ran like 70 minutes.
Right.
As you know, so, I mean, it was neat. It was cool. I don't think it's best of the year, but I don't discount it. I mean, I think it's going to give, like I said, I think War Horse is going to win the Academy Award. But I think the artist is going to give it a run for our money because both Hugo and War Horse, what they have going for them is Hollywood's so ridiculously narcissistic that they want to talk about themselves. So it's just isn't Hollywood great? Isn't Hollywood grand? Aren't we awesome? Isn't it great? Isn't it cool? So I think that, you know, the fact that Hollywood loves itself so much, it has a shot at picking up some major awards. You know, just same thing for Hugo. But
yes, I agree. Yes.
But you're right. I think it's a light, fluffy, airy movie. It's worthy of the accolades, but I don't think it's best of the year.
Yeah, and it's certainly worth your time. And you don't have to be a silent film fan to enjoy it. And you know, you shouldn't be put off by the fact that there's no dialogue. There's certainly still music. Mm. And I thought there's an effective bit later on that employs some music from Bernard Herrmann. Mm. And again, not trying to give too much away, but yeah. I thought it was a bit ballsy to use that particular music cue when they did. So.
All right. Well, let's go to the next one, which is My Week with Marilyn. Well, this is the last real quick one we're going to talk about. What did you think of that?
That's I thought a far less of that than the artist. Well, War Horse too. Well, My Week with Marilyn is all about Michelle Williams and her performance, and she's absolutely, utterly fantastic. I know you're not a fan of hers, and it's not so much about the appearance.
I hate Michelle Williams.
Okay, but I think she really does a fantastic job of embodying Marilyn, and it's not just
I don't think
it's pure imitation. I think she really captures the public and the personal, the private aspects of Marilyn, and the way she constantly shifts between the two, all, you know, within the same scenes. There's some real subtlety in her acting.
See, people say subtlety with her. I just see vacant, doughy-eyed, look in everything she has ever done. I give her credit in the sense that this isn't 100% a retread of Wendy and Lucy or Blue Valentine, but I think it's the same acting ability. It's just they're saying, okay, play airy. Now play depressed.
I think she has a lot more depth and range than you're giving her credit for.
I haven't seen it. I don't see it at all. I also think she's a shitty Marilyn Monroe because she needs to eat a fucking sandwich. And it's offensive too, to this degree, because the movie opens with this this was Diamonds Are the Girl, one of the musical numbers that Mary, I think it's Diamonds Are the Girl with a Friend, and they've got her doing it, but you can totally see they've got her hips padded.
Oh yeah.
So she has that shape, but then there's a later scene where she's, and I'm like, no padding. At least, I mean, because, and the thing is, she used to be a little chunky. And then she like lost all this weight and looks like she's a skeletal.
But don't blame
patient.
Her. Blame Hollywood for that.
No, I blame her.
I mean, that's you know, that's the
screw Hollywood. If you're gonna lose perfection. Weight, because I don't care. It's still her damn fault.
That's her idea of perfection. Well,
trust
I
me,
mean,
there
so
are plenty
actresses.
Of fat actresses out there.
Well, not if they want to be A-level actresses. You know, if they want to.
I think that's the other thing.
Very
you know
sad because when you see women going into the 30s who are actresses, and then they just start looking emaciated.
Well,
you know,
that's their own damn fault too. I mean, it's
could
just
could I just throw in Jennifer Connelly in there? But you know,
Jennifer
actress.
Connelly needs to eat a damn sandwich too. No, God, I just watched The Rocketeer this week, and she looked great. In
she
that
looked
film.
Fantastic. Yes, and I'm a vegetarian, and I would give her a ham sandwich. You know,
I'd give her a ham sandwich, but it wouldn't
here,
be
here. Gain some weight.
Oh, we're talking about a real ham sandwich now, aren't
yes,
we?
Yes, a real one. Yeah.
No, I think. This is the other thing I don't like about Michelle Williams. I think her fame is at least partly buoyed up in the poor little widow category, and that's I think where she got so much attention, which allowed her to that people like, oh, poor little widow, now she can show her range and her pain from Heath Ledger's death. I really
well, they
think
were already separated at that point.
You can't tell me that she wasn't the poor little widow, even if they were separated.
Sure.
After
sure.
he died, it was. You know what reminded me? It reminded me of Gwyneth Paltrow, who basically got famous by fucking Brad Pitt, and then they got her name in the news that way, and then started to get some roles. Because I don't think Gwyneth Paltrow is that good of an actress.
I agree with you there, but I disagree with you. Strongly about Michelle Williams.
That's okay. I'll take the horse for more horse before I'll take Michelle Williams. I thought the movie itself was kind of light and breezy. It felt like a BBC movie.
Yeah, it was really light. There was no depth to it either. And, you know, when your film depends, I mean, she's a central character, obviously, because it's called My Week with Marilyn, but she's still a secondary character in the story of the young publicist guy who, you know,
It's about the guy, and he's so
vacuous and bland and just infatuated with her. He has to be, you know, one of the most empty-headed protagonists, and he's a passive protagonist. He spends 2/3 of the film just sort of wandering around and watching things because that's what he is. That's what he does. And then you finally wait for him to get that week with Marilyn, and that's the last 20-30 minutes of the film.
Yeah. No, you're right. All right, so let's move on. Let's talk about the box office winners. This week, here's the thing. First of all, I do take issue with box office because there's people bemoaning about the people using the term. Nikki Fink, first of all, is an idiot. And she has been...
I disagree. No, I don't.
How can you disagree? Nikki Fink is a total moron. But she like goes on about a box office slump. Nobody's surviving this box office slump. Told you, box office slump.
Right.
Okay. The box office is not as strong as they want it to be, but
and it's less
what?
Than last year, so it's declined the last 2 years. So there's some concern there.
Yeah, technically a slump, but a lot of times, like if you look at like 2009, or actually early 2010, a lot of that box office power was responsible.
Avatar
and Alice in Wonderland were two huge hits that just raked in the money in that in January. That's why January had such a huge numbers. Whereas you're never going to reach that level. Now we're not at the same frame as that, but Sherlock Holmes 2 making $40 million, that's not bad. There's nothing wrong with a movie making $40 million. Yeah. That's not uncommon for me. I think that's about what Tron made when Tron was released.
But this was a sequel, and I think it's made less than the original. And I guess they were expecting or hoping that it would make more.
Everyone expects, but most sequels don't make as much as you. That's the thing.
Well, no, overall, you're right. I think there's always like a 20-30% drop off at the final box office. Yeah. But because, and obviously, you know, everyone would love to have the example of Batman Begins versus Dark Knight, where the sequel makes twice as much almost as the original and does that right off the bat because so many people caught up with the original on DVD, on Blu-ray, and, you know, cable. So you have that two-year
gap. I don't even think that's why The Dark Knight did so well. It was just, it was a badassly awesome movie. And you
right. But just that opening weekend gross, which was, you know, a combination of, I don't think
it had to do with people finding Dark Knight on DVD.
I think, well, we'll have to disagree. Batman Begins. I thought it was Batman Begins, people realizing it was a stronger film because there was all that, that sort of apathy that had developed over the previous iteration of the character and the franchise.
It was way better than the other Batman movies, but I would hardly call it. Batman Begins was a solid 3-star out of 5-star movie.
I thought it was a solid origin story, but relative to the other films, I thought it was fantastic. To the previous, Tim Burton.
I mean, you're coming off of Batman
Joel Schumacher.
Yes,
of course. But I think that's part of the reason why Batman Begins box office was a bit depressed, because there was that hangover from the earlier Batman films that people hadn't cleared out of their heads. And then when they did, they wanted to see the sequel and see what Nolan was going to do. And of course, there was also the Heath Ledger as the Joker aspect to it. That really played a huge part, I think, at least in the initial box office. And then, like you said, people realize this is an incredibly terrific film.
Yeah, but no, I saw it. Why are we talking about Batman? Let's talk about Sherlock Holmes.
We could talk about the trailer.
But the Sherlock Holmes, I thought $40 million is fair. And you're right, you get a drop off on a sequel. I don't think the public was clamoring for another Sherlock Holmes movie. I really don't think they were. I don't think the public was clamoring for another Alvin and the Chipmunks movie. They just did it because they could make a sequel. And honestly,
when the previous is so successful, it's almost automatic.
But the other thing is the last Alvin, both Sherlock Holmes and Alvin and the Chipmunks came out on Christmas Day, so they did not release at the same time. I think Hollywood has completely botched their release schedule since before Thanksgiving, where they release 3 kids movies on Thanksgiving weekend, and then they release nothing for a week, and then they release New Year's Eve and The Sitter, and then they release Sherlock Holmes the same time with Mission Impossible, and Mission Impossible did very well, even in the IMAX screens. And then this week, so there's like so many movies competing. I think Hollywood, normally they get their release schedules planned out right. I don't know what the hell happened in December because nobody was looking when they set these things up.
I think you're right about that to some extent, that you're going to have some films that are just going to fall under the radar because they're just cramming so many in the last weeks. That was one of my concerns with Tintin. As much as I liked it, you know, regardless of whether there's an audience for it or not, it just feels like there hasn't been enough of a push for it.
Yeah.
It's being released midweek, and then, you know, it's going to be Dragon Tattoo, which is a completely different audience. It's an R-rated film versus Tintin. Then War Horse coming out 5 days later or 4 days later just seems...
Yeah, and you got like We Bought a Zoo and The Darkest Hour crammed in there as well, along with whatever limited release stuff is eking out in your city. I think it's a very crowded week. And like I said, it makes no sense because like 3 weeks ago, there was nothing coming out. You know, I think Sherlock Holmes would have been better served if they released it the week after Thanksgiving.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, because there was nothing else in the box office that it would have had to compete with was Twilight, and Twilight won the box office that week with like 14 million.
Right.
You know, I think it's almost confusing to the audience, and that's why I think it, but ultimately the box office isn't that bad. This is not $40 million is not a bad opening for a movie. It's not like making 25 million, which is what I think something like Land of the Lost made.
And then dropped precipitously right after that.
Yeah, but I don't think Sherlock Holmes is going to have great staying power because again, you've got, you know, plenty of other movies made for the same audience come out. So do you even want to guess what's going to win next weekend? And do we count it as movies? Do we count War Horse as opening next weekend, this weekend?
Well, especially when it's actually opening on Christmas Day.
On a Sunday,
yeah.
You know, or is it going to be one of these things where it's like the top, the largest 6-day opening weekend ever?
I have no clue. I'm probably the worst box office prognosticator around when it comes to something like that. I mean, I expected Avatar 2 years ago to barely eke out 200 mil. and considering the budget was supposedly, what, 300, 350?
350, like, yeah.
Right, and then I was so completely wrong. And I remember walking out of the theater talking to other critics, at the press screening, and we all seemed to agree that it had some story problems, but the visuals were fantastic, and was there an audience willing to, take the journey with Cameron to this, completely alien world, no franchise, no pre-existing property, blah, blah, blah.
The answer was a big, big, huge yes.
Yes, absolutely. And people kept going back, and it was remarkable. And I still remember going to early morning screenings and seeing older couples taking and I had to ask them, who are you? What are you doing here on a weekday? And they were saying this was their fourth, their fifth time seeing seeing Avatar. And it was just such an experience. They had to re-experience it over and over again. And they saw it in every way possible, 2D, 3D, IMAX, you know?
I think I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Mission Impossible is going to win the weekend because it's opening technically wide on Wednesday.
And it's a PG-13 movie.
So much buzz.
It's a PG-13 movie, and that helps.
PG-13, yeah. I think Tintin has a shot, but I don't think it's going to have that wide of an I think a lot of people are looking at it as a kids movie.
Yes.
And it is. But it can be enjoyed by adults too. I think Mission Impossible is that four quadrant movie that I think is going to take over the weekend. But it's good they're all going to be like 40, 30, 20 million in this. It is going to be a huge grossing weekend if you take it from the spread of Wednesday through Monday or Wednesday through Sunday because there's so many movies opening and I think a lot of them, but I think they're not. No one's going to come out with this $70 million opening weekend simply because it's so crowded.
Yeah. Well, and I'm really, really curious how Dragon Tattoo is going to do. $100 million, $120 million budget, and it's an R-rated film. It's a hard R. You know, sure, it has a built-in audience from people who've read the book and are huge fans and maybe have seen
Only 50 million copies are in print. So, I mean, a lot of people read the book, but even if every one of those people goes to see the movie, it's still going to make $100 million, if that.
Yeah. I could see him hitting $100 million, but I don't see it hitting more than that.
Yeah. I don't think Dragon Tattoo is going to do well. I just don't. I think R rating is going to cripple it. I think it's known for being harder. It's a harder sell.
It's certainly not a four quadrant movie. No. It's like a one or two quadrant movie.
It's like half a quadrant. It's like if you like rape and tattoos and torture and murder and serial killers, then this one's for you.
Yes.
So I do not.
And the best use of an Enya song ever, but
yeah, I just do not. Is it Fincher's first R rated movies since what, Zodiac? And Zodiac bombed.
Did Zodiac do that badly?
Zodiac did not do well. I'm pretty sure.
I think he had a more controlled budget or a smaller budget on that one, since it wasn't essentially a period film or a film.
No, in a foreign country. Well, it was a period film, but
it was a period film. I'm sorry. Yes,
but it wasn't like it wasn't. Zodiac made $33 million.
Really?
Total.
That's it.
That's domestic box office. Production budget of 65, which is still big, and it had a worldwide of 85. So, yeah, it's not a. I think that Dragon Tattoo is going to be very much like Zodiac. It's going to suffer the same problems. It's going to have the same, and it's going to be just as good. So, anyways.
Wait, you like Zodiac or no?
I love Zodiac.
Oh, okay.
I thought Zodiac was a fantastic movie.
Well, what I loved about Zodiac, that it was really two movies in one. So you paid one ticket price, you got two films.
Yeah, kind of like Australia.
God, no, no. That was sort of the anti-Zodiac. Horrible, horrible film. Unless you see it as unintentional comedy or camp, maybe.
Well, that's kind of everything from Baz Luhrmann.
Yes, it's played that way.
Certain camp. Let's move on to listener emails. We got a couple emails here. One is from Thomas from Seattle. I'm going to summarize this because it's relatively it's a long email. But basically, he's asking if the information about a movie leading up to the release is too available now. You know, sort of like back when we were kids, it took a movie 6 months or a year to actually hit videotape, and it was very hard to get stories, and stories would come out like Starlog or Fangoria or a magazine. You don't have the ubiquitous internet press now that you do now.
There are reports of every small detail about a film. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's an on-set photo of the fifth lead actor in this film in costume. It's like, okay.
And even Thomas makes a point. He's like, they cut trailers now before the film's cast. Or before they start shooting.
Yeah.
And, or they're still like, they come out with like when that, like the Dark Knight, we'll talk in a little bit about the Dark Knight and the Hobbit trailers. But when they made that first Dark Knight Rises teaser trailer came out this summer, they show this teaser trailer, which literally has one shot from the new movie.
Yes. Yes.
And
which then, really like, felt like they were a huge cheese. Like, why even bother releasing this? Well, just to remind us, it was just to remind us that it's coming next year. Yeah.
Yeah. And then 3 months later, they're talking about, we've cast this person. You're just like, wait a minute. I thought you were shooting the movie. So what do you think? Do you think it loses something? Are we losing the anticipation and mystery a little bit?
I'll give you a flat out yes. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think you mentioned earlier, it's just the internet press, and that's, you know, where the hits come. That's where the ad revenue comes from. So there is sort of that massive competition going on all the time to get as much information about a movie out before it comes out, you know.
And you
just
get
months in advance, a year in advance,
bootlegs, you know, and bootlegs of trailers and illegal downloads and stuff like that. Because we had that this week with the Dark Knight Rises trailer. People were bootlegging it and then linking to it from sites, and I know a lot of editors and people who work for these sites, and they're yelling at each other going, well, you put this up there and it wasn't approved and so and this and that. So
the reason I wouldn't do it, well, there is an ethical reason because it's a bootleg, but the other aspect of it is it looks horrible. I don't want to see it that way. So
what about like the Dragon Tattoo leaked bootleg that leaked like a year ago, but it was obvious that it was so clear that Columbia leaked it, but they never said they did just because they knew people would post it.
Right.
Do you remember that one which had like the Nine Inch Nails music, which has at all even remotely close to the feel of the movie?
Although it is Trent Reznor doing his industrial soundscape stuff. But
yeah.
Yeah.
So no, I think we are losing it. And it's very hard in our industry to avoid as much spoilers and extra stuff. I mean, when they're announcing cameos, Like with the whole Wolverine cameo in X-Men First Class, where it got announced, which is ridiculous. I mean,
yeah, that would have been a nice surprise for fans of the series to find out on their own. Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, I definitely think we're losing. I think things are overreported and minutiae is reported, and it's hard to hide from this stuff. Whereas I remember when I was a kid, it's just like nobody. Like I remember when Gremlins came out, and they wouldn't show you what the Gremlin looked like. They did the same thing with Alien. They wouldn't show you what the Alien.
I remember the Alien ads and the cracking egg and the sound and space. No one can hear you scream. And
but you weren't. No one saw the actual Alien. No one saw the Mogwai and the Gremlins before the movie came out. It was a big deal.
Yeah. I think some of the TV ads, you know, might have shown the egg and the quick explosion of the face hugger, but it was so fast that you didn't know what you were looking at. There was
context. You never saw the alien, the
foreground
alien.
Right, absolutely. And it was that was one of the reasons you went, because you didn't know what it looked like.
Yeah.
And now you know everything. And of course, you know, there were so many shots from the Batman set in Pittsburgh over the summer. It was just incredible. Every day there were 4, 5, 6 new photos, you know, just like, yeah. Wow, I almost don't want to see this. And I guess my question to you is, will you, if you get the chance, see the prologue? Or would you prefer to see it, not see it at all?
All it is the first 6 minutes of the actual movie, if it was something totally different, if you got something that you didn't see in the movie, I'd be interested. But if all it is just the first 6 minutes, I'm not interested in seeing the prologue. I'll see the prologue when the movie comes out. That's my opinion.
That's my preference, too. Yeah. I'd rather have some surprises. I mean, I already have heard or read a little bit about what the content of it is, and it makes a lot of sense relative to the way The Dark Knight was structured.
I mean, it's very similar. I do my best. I'm actually pretty good at avoiding spoilers, even in the job, because I don't work in the news section. I work in reviews, so I can avoid a lot of this. And I mean, it took me. I just watched today. We'll talk about this real quick, because we got other things to talk about. But the Dark Knight Rises trailer came out. I finally watched it today. I've avoided it until now. You know, even on Twitter, people talking about it, I've avoided it just because I'm like, man. And what did you think? What do you think of this Dark Knight trailer?
What did I think? Yeah. It felt a little, I'll say abstract, but maybe a little unfocused. But that was fine. I didn't feel like it gave you too much. It just gave you hints and left a lot of questions about who Bane was and what his plan is. And the way it introduced Catwoman, which was, I thought, one of the more interesting aspects of it, is that, you know, she's using language that comes out of the Occupy Wall Street movement in a very sort of sharp way. You know, I was expecting to see Catwoman introduced in an action scene, an action sequence, you know, not whispering into Bruce Wayne's ear about, you know, her political agenda. So, and but the negative to me was I thought the visual effects of the collapsing stadium were just horrendous. And I really,
well, but those are probably going to be improved.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure they'll be fixed or improved upon. But I also felt like, well, if they weren't ready, why would they include it in the initial trailer?
I don't know.
Yes,
because it's football season.
Yes, and that was Hines Ward. So, you know, someone commented about that. Well, I mean, he's a football player for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and it was filmed in Pittsburgh.
Yeah,
parts of it, and also, you know, other people connected it to Burt Ward.
But here's my question:
Adam West's original.
What the hell was that British kid singing about? Why?
British kid.
The beginning, and he sounded like the boys' choir British kid. I guess, was he singing the national anthem or singing the Gotham anthem or whatever? This is where, first of all, I am not very much like I am with David Fincher. I am not of that camp that Nolan could do no wrong.
And
with that, I think Nolan's made a couple fantastic movies, being Memento and The Dark Knight. I think he's made some okay movies, like The Prestige, and I liked Inception, but I didn't think it had. I thought it had some serious flaws.
I would put Dark Knight first, Prestige second, Memento third.
But see, Inception would be near good.
Well, not near, in the middle somewhere.
Yeah, but I mean, and I recently rewatched Insomnia, which I'm like,
The original, I hate to throw that. The original is so much better, but it really is.
It really is. But my point being is I've had a bad feeling about The Dark Knight Rises, and it just feels like it's that it's going down that road. And what I've seen, I feel the movie's overcast. Not dark and gloomy. It's too many cast. Yes. When they were saying,
too many
recognizable playing this
actors,
and so,
right.
Yeah, too many characters. It's going to get crowded. And then I look at this, that kid singing just felt inauthentic. It felt like let's put this football player from the Pittsburgh Steelers in there just to have this scene in there. There's nothing about that trailer that wowed me. There's nothing about the teaser that wowed me either, for that matter. No, it might be fantastic. Who knows? But I think a lot of what made The Dark Knight great was Heath Ledger and the portrayal of the Joker and what they had with there. I don't know if they're going to get that for Bane.
Right. Well, that's a really good question, and that's what it comes down to me. Regardless of the teaser or the trailer, even if the trailer was better, that's still the huge unanswered question we won't know the answer to until next summer. But how do you top Dark Knight?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's the absolute best superhero film. If you want to call it grounded, real reality-based, where no one has a superpower, absolutely the best out there. So how do you top that? You know, it almost feels like that should have been the end of the series. You know, it's like, well,
yeah.
You know, when you have that great a villain and you've got that great motivation for the villain or lack of motivation for the villain and the anarchist and the terrorist and the journey it takes Bruce Wayne's character. And I thought all of that was just fantastic. And the introduction of, you know, the secondary villain, which I had some concerns about, Two-Face, Harvey Dent. How do you do, you know, and in that case, I thought they really handled a second villain relatively well. I still had some minor issues with that. But like you said, it seems like Nolan went all out and put everybody he knows and likes and respects, you know, from Inception. It's like, oh, Marion Cotillard's in it, you know.
Who I think is overrated.
Right, but Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who I think is a fantastic actor and the best actor of his generation next to Ryan Gosling. They're both practically the same age. But really, how many more actors can you put in the film?
Yeah,
you
know? I don't know. Yeah, and I don't know. We'll stop talking about this here. But I just, like I said, I just wasn't wowed by it. I don't feel the same oomph that I felt when I saw those first Dark Knight ads. Now, do you want to talk real quickly about the Hobbit trailer? Really quickly, because we're running out of time.
Okay. Well, just three words. I loved it.
Okay.
And my biggest problem with it is that it was just a reminder that we're going to have to wait an entire year to see the first part of the Hobbit film.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how many? Is it two parts?
It's going to be two parts. And it's December again, December 2012, 2013, the way they released the original trilogy.
Yeah. It looks like it's at least very true to the obviously, because it's got the same director and all.
Oh, right, of course.
I have three words to say about too much singing, and that's all I really have to say about that. I never
I wasn't a big fan of that, but you know, just the return of the world and the fact that we got so many more visuals and introductions to the characters, I thought was really strong. And you got a little bit of the story in there. And I felt that they did a good job of introducing Martin Freeman as Bilbo.
I think he'll be good.
Yes.
Long night. I like Martin Freeman, so we'll see. Let's move on to the next. I got a question from Facebook, and it's sort of a couple part question. The first part is, when you're creating your top 10 or bottom 10 of the year list, do you include straight to video or does it have to be theatrical releases? For example, can you put the Howling Reborn or even the new Hellraiser movies on your worst of the year list? And then also, what do you do if you make your list and you publish it and get it out there and then you see a movie and you're just like, wow, that was terrible, or that was fantastic, and it would then go on your list? Do you revise it at all? This is from Gabe, who dreamed he was Steve, on Facebook. What do you think? Do you ever count straight to video for worst of the year?
I don't, because I think there's already the assumption that there's a reason why they're straight to video. Not always true, but more often than not. So I don't include them. I only include theatrical releases. The bigger problem is the second part of that question, which is right. I mean, sometimes you're asked to do your editors, they want that top 10 list before the end of the year, and you can't, there's still films that haven't been released yet, or you haven't gotten a chance to see that might make the list. And that's where I kick myself. And sometimes that list has to be final, and then I just treat it as, well, it's final for that particular site, because that's the date they want it. That's the cutoff. That's what they get. And then hopefully for another site, I'll have the freedom to write a more complete list or make some changes relative to, whatever I saw in that last week. So,
yeah, I would say unless I screw up, I try not to include straight to video releases on a worst of the year, because you're right. If it's going straight to video, it's probably crappy anyways. And in fact, I grade these things differently. I remember I watched the Howling Reborn and the Wrong Turn 4. Mm-hmm. I watched both of those like the same week, and they were bad movies, but then I'm like, well, they're interactive video movies, and they're like the fourth, fifth sequel to movies. The Howling, that was a sequel to a movie that came out in 1980. I mean, how good could it be? And every now and then I see a movie, like there was one called Amusement. It wouldn't have been best of the year, but it's a movie called Amusement that was supposed to get a theatrical but didn't get it. It was actually a really good little horror movie, and I was like, that was actually quite surprising, and I got a good grading. But I'll be a lot kinder. Like, I didn't give like The Howling Reborn like 0 stars, but if I went and saw it in the theater, it might have gotten that, because it's The Howling Part 8 or whatever.
Oh my God. Has it really been that many films? Yeah.
I don't know how many. There have been a bunch. But you have to sit there and be like, if they did Witchboard Part 56, are you really going to be like, well, that was the worst of the year? And the other reason is that just makes more work for me, because then I'd have to have then I'd have to kind of see as much as I could on video, and I just don't have time for that. It's hard enough to watch all the movies that are out.
Yes.
In theatrical. So no, I don't do those for those. But when it comes to the end of the year, I don't actually publish best or worst of the years exclusively of my choice anywhere but on my own website. And when I do, that's my best of the year. If I happen to see a movie 3 weeks later that I missed, like, I never saw Killer Elite, for example. I'm just pulling that out as a movie I didn't see. Nothing against it. Maybe I'll see it and I'll be like, either this is the greatest movie I've ever seen or the worst movie I've ever seen. I'm not going to go revise my list. That was just an oversight on mine, and there's a lot of movies I haven't had a chance to see. I remember a couple years ago, several years ago, The World's Fastest Indian came out. I never saw it. Actually, it was sent to screener. Never got around to watching it. And I'm like, it could have made my top 10 list that year, because I really enjoyed that movie, but I didn't see it until late. Oh, well, that happens. And whereas every now and then I get, like, I remember I got All About Steve, was it 2-3 years ago when that came out? I got the DVD of All About Steve in December. I hated that movie so much that it caused me to, fortunately I saw it before I wrote my top 10 worst list of the year, because it made me revise it, because it was such a bad movie. But yeah, once I publish my list, it's there, because there could always be some independent film I didn't even hear about.
Right.
That maybe they didn't even put it, didn't give an awards push to. And then I see it and think it's charming and wonderful, and it would have made my top 10 list, but I just didn't see it that year. So, I mean, it's kind of like, oh, well, but, you know, no one sees, unless you can afford to see every single movie that comes out in a calendar year theatrically, you're never going to have the comprehensive list.
Right, yes. So. I'm always impressed by, well, someone unnamed, but maybe I'll name him, Drew McQueenie, when he was talking.
Drew McQueenie.
Yeah, on Twitter about how many movies he's seen this year, and I think he said he's close to well over 200. And then he basically goes through the list and just starts culling, and, you know, I usually just go through a list of theatrical releases and then just pull 30, 40 films just off sort of the eye test, and then I'll start rearranging them and thinking about them a little harder. And hopefully by that point, you know, it is the end of the year and I've seen practically everything, but I don't, you know, as far as new releases, I'd say probably about 125 to 150 new releases a year.
Well, I'll give you an example. We Bought a Zoo comes out this week. We did an at screening in Columbus. I couldn't even go on to Cleveland to see it because it was the date that was conflicting with Sherlock Holmes. So there was no way for me to see it in advance. And Fox did not send a screener. Now, I am likely to not like it because I'm not a big Cameron Crowe fan. But I might see it. I'll probably get it on DVD or Blu-ray to review. I might see it and be like, that was a great movie. But, oh well. And I'm not going to go see it next week because it's kind of being good. I'm not going to bother.
So. Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes. Yeah. And I hate to say that sometimes, you know, yes, we are influenced by what other critics have said. And those who caught at a very early screening and I think another screening subsequent to that, I haven't heard very much positive. And that's a film, it's being sold, obviously, as a family film. And I think it's really sort of lowest common denominator in the way it's set up. And
yeah.
Regardless of whether you have an issue with zoos or not, and that recent incident with that Bizarro guy, wasn't he in? Where was that guy? Mm-hmm. Wasn't he in Ohio? The one who had all the exotic animals?
Oh yeah, no, that was down the road.
Oh
that
my
was like,
god,
that was
that
about 40 minutes. 40 minutes.
Wow, that's
of us.
Crazy. West and then us, and they had to kill all the animals, which is just horrible. You know, I mean, I know there were some animal rights activists, and my initial reaction was, why did they kill all of them? But they were on the loose, and, you know,
well,
the cops had no other choice.
Do you know why they had to kill him? Because it was going to be dark soon, and people had to go to school the next day. And the last thing you need is a rogue tiger picking off kids from a bus stop or in their own backyard. Just
and
going
not to mention,
out to,
right,
you
know, the darkness though would give them hours to get away, and it'd be harder to capture. No, I think it is an incredible tragedy, but
Actually, have you ever seen the movie Elephant in the Living Room?
Elephant? No, I don't believe I have.
That's a good movie. And it's a documentary about exotic animals. Again, Ohio, dead center in this whole thing. There's a guy whose lions escaped in the car, and it was from Dayton. And he had lions that escaped, and they were attacking cars on the freeway. And you're just like, wow. And they have a guy, again, from Ohio, who's a deputy somewhere, whose job is to go to exotic animal exhibits and try and buy the most dangerous thing available. And he was like going to buying like places literally within an hour's drive from my house, going to places and buying like the most poisonous land snake known to man. Just for like $100 with no permit or nothing. So yeah, that shit happens.
Wow.
But anyways, We Bought a Zoo. Well, you're right. There was the buzz was sort of mixed. What I found more interesting was the fact that Fox has had no push whatsoever to try and get anybody to see or consider this for awards. And I'm like, well, then no one, then this can't be that good. If they're not going to push this movie, they're not. It's not that good.
I think sadly you're right.
Let's move on to our Fat Guy 5. And this is in honor of, oh shit, what is this in honor of? This is in honor of the girl with the dragon tattoo. There we go. It is 5 great English language remakes. And we're just going to go through the list. And what's funny is I realized that a good chunk of these are horror movies.
And maybe they translate better.
Well, I think the most innovative stuff is being done by foreign markets in terms of horror movies, because in terms at least mainstream American cinema, horror is incredibly imitative, and so when there's something new and innovative done, it was done by the Japanese, it's been done by the French, it's been done by the Spanish or whatever. So I think it just happens to be that way. The first one on the list is Quarantine, which is a remake of the movie Wreck.
Which is fantastic, by the way.
Both are fantastic. Yeah. I think they're both fantastic films. They're almost shot for shot, except for the very, very end. And, of course, the sequels then go off in completely different directions.
Right.
But I haven't
seen a sequel to Quarantine, so I can't say.
I don't want to see the sequel.
Yeah, I didn't hear very much. It was straight to DVD, right?
Straight to video, right?
Straight to video. Yes.
I've seen the trailer to the sequel to Quarantine, and I don't want to see much more. It looks terrible.
Well, and the original Quarantine wasn't even screened for the press. I believe.
It was screened for me.
It did.
It was one of those weird things where they like screened it on like a Thursday night.
Thursday night at 10 p.m. I've been to some of those. It's like, okay, you're challenging me to write that review tonight, aren't you?
I'm just glad that they show it because I don't have to spend $8 to go see it or whatever.
True enough. Well, and my other choice is going to an early weekend matinee, the first screening. Yeah. Even if it's like 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm there because I don't want to pay anything but a bargain matinee price.
No, but I like both Quarantine and Wreck, so I think that was definitely a good English language remake. Do you want to hit the next one?
We were going to skip Let Me In, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
We can't. Oh, pull the veil back.
Okay. Yes. We were going to go and discuss The Ring.
Yeah.
And The Ring and The Grudge to me are actually, and then after that, The
Grudge. These are both, these are the next two on the list.
And The Ring remake essentially caused The Grudge to be remade too once The Ring became such a successful movie commercially. You know, Hollywood studios, producers were out there looking for other Japanese or Asian language Asian made films with horror themes and remaking them here, and most of those failed pretty badly. So that J-horror trend is pretty much done. But The Ring is one film that I saw the remake first before the original, and I loved it. I actually loved the remake. It's Gore Verbinski, the Pirates of the Caribbean guy, Rango, and I thought all of those were we won't discuss those right now outside of Rango, which I thought was fantastic, but the first Pirates anyway. But I thought The Ring really brought something a little bit different to the property, to the material, than the original, which was fantastic on its own. When I went and revisited it, it was interesting that the original is about a half hour shorter, and it's tighter, but I like the changes that they made to the remake. And it also had Naomi Watts, who's, a fantastic actress, in a horror film, so it was sort of an A-level horror film. The Grudge had Sarah Michelle Gellar, who's not an A-level actress, but it was fun on its own. That one was pretty much just a vignettes. It was sort of a ghostly serial killer setup.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about how many different kills can you get and how inventive you can get in basically 90 minutes. And the answer was very.
Yeah, very much. Well, and I think it was neat to see The Ring and The Grudge. And I think part of the reason they were such hits in the U.S. was because they were new. They were different. We hadn't seen that. But then when they started doing that, and J-horror is such a bad term for it because there's Korean and Chinese movies. But you had stuff like One Missed Call and Pulse and what is it, The Eye.
I've forgotten about all of them.
All of these, and The Messengers even. These are all just remakes or derivative movies of these Asian horror films.
And The Uninvited, you forgot The Uninvited, which is a remake of my favorite horror film of the last 10 years.
Wow.
The Tale of Two Sisters, which is a Korean film, and I think it's one of the best fantastic films.
Yeah.
It's got horror, it's got psychological horror, you know, it's got some real scares and shocks, plus it actually has some subtext and a really strong story. And the remake absolutely positively botched it, as you would expect.
Well, and part of the problem is, even though some of these earlier movies, like The Eye actually is an okay movie, and the remake actually isn't terrible. I mean, the remakes of The Eye is very much a one-to-one comparison. But the thing is, The Ring and The Grudge were really cool because they were new. And then when we got The Ring 2, we got The Grudge 2, we got all these other movies, what happened was we realized that it was just new to us.
Right.
They'd been making this stuff in Japan and China and Hong Kong and Korea for years, And so it was nothing new to the Asians, but it was new to us. So it's kind of like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. When it came out, they're like, oh, it's new and original. And people like, I was talking to a guy who was a Chinese actor because he was working on a film. And he's like, oh, yeah, in Hong Kong. They're like, whatever. We've seen this. We've been doing wire work for years. And so it was really new and innovative. And then when it showed up and everything, people just were like, well, that's stupid now. And right. I think that's kind of what happened to the J-horror trend. But those two were really great remakes. The sequels, not so much.
Yes.
So the next one is The Departed, which is a remake of the Chinese film. It's a Hong Kong film, Infernal Affairs.
Not a horror film.
No, it's a gangster film.
Yes.
It was funny, as I was telling Mel off the air, I said, I have a copy of Infernal Affairs. I've had it for years. I've just never watched it. I almost got rid of it, and then I realized it was the original film of The Departed, so I didn't get rid of it. Still haven't watched it because I'm an idiot and I don't have time to do it. But The Departed was one of Martin Scorsese's great films and very deserving of the Oscar, in my opinion. I love this film.
So very deserving of the Oscar. Well, maybe it did, maybe not. His direction always fantastic, but we're not going to get into a discussion of essentially another film review, but that's one where I thought the original and the original's ending was far superior to the American remake. And you really should, when you get a chance. I know you always have so many films to see, as do I. Yeah. To catch the original, it's shorter, tighter. I think it has sort of the same comparisons of the Ring, the two versions, the original.
But does it have Mark Wahlberg in it? That's the big question.
It does not. It does not.
Oh, boom. There you go.
But it has two great Hong Kong actors in it and a great supporting cast, tightly directed. Again, it's, you know, I think roughly a half hour shorter. And it's just has a, I think the ending is better. It's much more cynical and downbeat, which a lot of these Asian gangster films tend to have.
It's not like The Departed was like a journey through, it wasn't the ending of The Artist or anything like that.
Right. But there's a sense of comeuppance that happens in The Departed.
Well, don't say any more, because if you want me to see it, don't spoil anything more for me.
Oh, okay. Well, I was talking just about The Departed. But, okay. But yeah, all right. So, but you should see it.
That's my right. It's on my list at some point.
546.
That's right.
Yeah.
The last one we'll do really quickly and then get out of the segment is Victor Victoria, which actually has been remade several times. This original German film from 1933, which, guess what it was called? Victor und Victoria. But Victor Victoria by Blake Edwards was a great film. Hilarious. And just, it's just brilliantly done. It's a charming, wonderful, fun movie that breaks a lot of taboos, especially for the 80s.
Yeah, it was like 1982. Yeah,
it was 81, 82, something like that. And you know, they have like, you know, they treat certain sexual elements and they dabble in some somewhat bawdy appearance of homosexuality and sort of, I guess,
cross-dressing and trans,
sort of stereotype bending. Yes. Things you, and even nowadays today you don't get that sort of thing. A lot of times, like if you watch like a show like Ugly Betty, which was on a while ago, they're like, or even like Glee, and you get somebody, you're like, oh, the gay kid, but he's totally flamboyant and a flat fashionista and is in show choir and everything, and it's like, what, you're just nothing original. You got just the same gay character that was played off the Jack Tripper character from the 80s. Let's, you know, can we grow beyond that and have just a regular person who happens to be gay, you know? So I think that Victor Victoria breaks those boundaries, 30 years ago. So, you know, that's an
excellent
great
observation. As far, I didn't even know, or maybe I knew but forgot, that it was a remake of an earlier film, because it does feel like it's really fresh and of the time. It's set in the 30s and it's set in Europe, right? But
yeah,
to think that actually there was an original that may have actually explored some of the same issues about gender and sexuality, and also doing it in a very light comic way too, all the way through. I mean, it's always played as a farce, and you know, Julie Andrews playing a down and out character who, you know, she's a female singer, so she pretends to be a man who pretends to be a woman. So it really starts spinning your head around, like, who's playing what role at what time, you know? And you know, you've got some great character actors and some real surprises as to where they end up with each other. So, and it kind of reminded me a little bit of the Some Like It Hot from 1960, which also sort of, or 59, which plays with a lot of the same ideas, you know. And I, killer ending. I love the ending of Some Like It Hot, you know, that no one's perfect. And not to give away, if you haven't seen it, see it. You know, it's Marilyn Monroe. We talked about Marilyn Monroe earlier tonight. The real Marilyn Monroe. And Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis, and they were never better, you know. And it's also Billy Wilder who wrote, directed that. So it's a fantastic comedy, and has a lot to offer just beyond the comedy itself. Yep. So
awesome. Well, you know, with that, we got to go to a break, and when we get back, we'll talk some DVDs. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. I almost started the show all over again. welcome back. We just got out of the middle segment where we had a great discussion. I talked a little bit more, but we talked about War Horse, and we talked about Ghost Protocol, and we answered some viewer or listener feedback, and did a great Fat Guy 5, talked about the Dark Knight Rises trailer, did mini reviews of movies like Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, My Week with Marilyn, The Artist. So we had a great little segment, and worth going checking back. It's not as respectful as the one we did with Devendra a couple weeks ago, but it's also not as bawdy as we did with Gray Drake last week. So, Mel, you're right in the middle.
Awesome.
You should feel proud. But now, what do we have coming up here?
I think it just might be the world famous DVD roundup.
That's right. Yeehaw. We got DVDs. I'm just going to zip through these real quick. There's One Tree Hill season 8. I have no idea why I even put that on my list. You also have Futurama season 6, which is a neat little show. I didn't like it initially, but it kind of grew on me a little bit.
Yes.
Did you have something to say about Futurama?
No, just that in general, I love the show, but okay.
No, okay. I did not see Straw Dogs, so I don't know if that's a decent remake. Did you see it?
I would say decent, but unnecessary.
Okay. There's also the Glee 3D concert movie, speaking of movies that are completely and utterly unnecessary.
Yes.
There's Columbiana, which was interesting enough, but it's just so utterly unbelievable. It's like a Three Stooges movie.
It's unbelievably derivative. Yes.
Yeah, it's I don't know. It's just really silly.
I couldn't even bring myself to review it. That's how bad it was.
Yeah, I went to go see it. I paid money to go see it did 10 a.m. screening.
I did too.
Dolphin Tale, which I wasn't wild about, but it seemed to be a, you know, very popular family kind of film. So
I purposely avoided it.
Yeah, it's cheesy.
Morgan Freeman, yes. The voice of God, yes.
Yeah. So there's that. And then there's Midnight in Paris, which I thought was cute and charming, but first of all, I'm not a huge Woody Allen fan. So I like his earlier stuff. I like his more cynical stuff.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Likewise, yes.
Yeah, I mean, like I liked Annie Hall. I thought that was fun. And I liked, like Match Point. He had this run a couple of years ago with Match Point, and I thought Scoop was okay. But, you know, like Vicky Cristina Barcelona, now he's getting very serious and artistic and contemplative. And that's the problem I had with Midnight in Paris is it completely plays to the people that it berates at the end of the movie. Because it basically says, quit romanticizing
the past,
the 20s and the past. And it's totally made for people who romanticize the 20s of Paris. I actually had somebody say, she's like, oh, it's a great movie. If you've ever wanted to be an artist in the 20s, it's the kind of movie to see. And then I saw the movie and I'm kind of like, no, the whole point of the movie is to not do that.
Right.
So.
Live in the present. Find your own golden age. Yes.
Exactly. What do you got coming up here for DVDs and Blu-rays?
Oh, my gosh.
You have one.
One? I do?
Yeah, with Kevin Spacey.
Oh, Margin Call. I'm so sorry. Right, because that came out on VOD and limited theatrical release, and now it's on DVD Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And that comes with, I won't say the highest, but the next highest recommendation, whatever the next level is. It's a terrific cast. One of those, I won't say it's Glenn Ross level. Writing or performances, but I think it's fairly close that you really get a strong sense of all the characters, the interplay between the characters, interactions, the time period, the financial meltdown, and it really makes that whole period that takes place over just a day or night.
It's an overnight thing. Yeah.
Right. It makes it incredibly fascinating, compelling, something I didn't think was really actually possible in a film that was non-documentary. In a documentary, yes, when you have more time to explain things, but the way they sort of really paced things out, or the writer, director did, I was really impressed. So
yeah,
that would be my recommendation.
I was surprised at how much I liked Margaret Call, and I think it's a great companion piece with a movie like The Ides of March, which will both make you so depressed about the way of the world we live in and the systems that are in place that don't protect us whatsoever. I think Margin Call was very well done, especially in the sense that it didn't shake its finger. And I thought that was neat that it didn't shake its finger, but it was just kind of like, well, this is what people do. You put people in control of this kind of thing and they're going to protect themselves and the heck with everyone else. And I think that was a very realistic portrayal. And I don't work on Wall Street, so obviously, I'm definitely one of the 99% here. So it's one of those movies that I think is incredibly well done. So yeah, good one. And then the stinker, I'm putting in Warrior as the stinker.
I agree with you 150%.
I believe it was you who had warned me against this when I saw it, and it just was so long-winded. And the problem is the trailer. If you watch the trailer, it tells you everything that happens in the first 2 hours of the movie. The movie's 2 hours and 10 minutes long.
Yes,
it's the most pointless film ever made.
Right. Well, the trailer, all the commercials, they all show the two of them fighting. It's like, well, the only way they're going to fight is if they both reach the final bout,
And they have this, it's like tries to be intellectual with them. So we're gonna play Beethoven when they come out. And I'm like, really? And you're gonna play the same Beethoven theme over and over again, and you're gonna work out to the same Beethoven track. And then also they have like Nick Nolte's characters listening to Moby Dick, and I'm like, I get it. You've got something to prove. You've got your own white whale you're fighting against.
Right. It was just so over obvious, and it was contrived.
Yeah,
it was one of the most contrived melodramas. And you know what? For any writer, any critic, any moviegoer who's male and who loved Warrior, you really cannot complain about rom-coms and women enjoying rom-coms if you really think that Warrior is a great film.
I'm gonna have
because
to interrupt
it's
you
a
there.
Male whip.
I got to interrupt you there because we got to go because we got about 10 seconds left. Anyways, thanks, Mel, for being on with us. Tell
My
us
pleasure.
Real quick where you can get you. Quick.
E-film critic, SF Station, veryware.com.
All right, talk to you guys next week.
Okay, thank you.